Hi, I'm Lorraine Rapp.
And I'm Linda Lowen.
Welcome to Take Care, a weekly conversation on health and wellness produced by WRVO Public Media. On today's show, if you've ever counted the number of steps you take using an old-school pedometer, you won't believe what the latest fitness gadgets can do. A technology expert for USA Today guides us through the next big thing in wellness gadgets, fitness trackers, which measure how active you are, how many calories you burn, and how much you sleep. Find out how a fitness tracker can put you on the right track toward better health.
But first, there are few things in life that can shift your mood or improve your day as much as hearing a song you like. Whether it's listening to the radio, a home stereo system, or a portable MP3 player, many of us can't make it through a single day without music. Why are we so influenced by music? Why do we buy songs and albums, attend concerts, sing in the shower, and go to the effort of learning to play a musical instrument? Why does music matter?
The explanation is due in part to reward, anticipation, prediction of the future, and recreation of the past. And the answers lie deep within the human brain. Neuroscientists have discovered compelling reasons for our strong behavioral response to music. In fact, two Canadian researchers recently covered the subject for the New York Times in an essay entitled Why Music Makes Our Brains Sing. One of them is with us today. Dr. Robert Zatori is a professor of neuroscience at the Montreal Neurological Institute and Hospital at McGill University. He joins us to explain his findings. Welcome to Take Care, Dr. Zatori.
Hello.
You know, music has been around a long time. It's ancient. It's been discovered that primitive societies dating back to Paleolithic times carve flutes out of animal bones. And you say in your piece that music brings a unique pleasure to humans, and most of us have experienced that pleasure. What has your research revealed as to why music affects us the way it does?
Well, it's remarkable, isn't it, that music really gives such universal pleasure to almost everybody. And what's remarkable about it, perhaps, is that unlike other things that are valuable, music doesn't have any specific biological value. In other words, you can't eat it, it doesn't keep you warm in the winter, you can't mate with it. In other words, it's purely abstract. It's a pattern of sounds. And yet people find it immensely rewarding. And in our research, we've found that many of the same circuits of the brain that are typically associated with those, what we would call primary rewards, like food, for instance, are also engaged by music. So that has led us down the path of trying to understand how is it that these abstract patterns of sound elicit such pleasure.
You describe a peak emotional moment when you feel a chill of pleasure that causes the release of dopamine. Explain how that works. What have you discovered?
Right. So in order to study this, it's actually kind of tricky because different people have different responses to music, and it's very hard to pinpoint exactly what's going on. And so we thought that we could capitalize on this experience that many, but not all people have, to particular passages of music where it's so beautiful, it's so emotionally engaging that you feel a chill or shivers down the spine or that kind of sensation. And what's cool about that is that when it happens, we can actually detect it by measuring things like changes in skin conductance or in heart rate. So that gives us an objective measurement of what's going on subjectively in the person's mind. And so once we've identified that moment of the music, we can put people in a certain kind of brain scanning machine that allows us to trace the activity of certain molecules. And then we see that at that peak moment, there is a release of this neurotransmitter called dopamine. So that's a chemical messenger that is really associated with a lot of these primary rewards. So if you take an animal and you train it to receive a food reward for a particular action, you will see its dopamine neurons firing, often in anticipation of the food that's going to come up. And so we're drawing a link between this very abstract, what we might call a cognitive reward, which is music, to a very, very basic biological function that has to do with survival, such as obtaining food.
So why is it significant that dopamine gets released in anticipation of that pleasurable moment?
Well, I think there are two reasons. On the biological spectrum, it allows us to draw these links to other kinds of events that are going on. in the brain. And a lot of people have considered that the brain is kind of a prediction machine. In order to survive in the environment, you have to try to anticipate what's going to happen to you and take actions to either prevent something bad from happening or to obtain something good. So the better you can predict, the more successful you'll be. And the human brain is particularly good at making predictions, both in the short term and in the medium term and even, you know, in very long term, like years ahead. So that's on the one hand. But on the musical side, when we talk to musicologists and to musicians, composers, music theorists, many of them tell us that there's a remarkably similar phenomenon where if you have a pattern of sounds, let's say a chord progression, you will be led to anticipate a particular ending to that chord progression. And everyone knows what this is. When you're hearing a piece of music, you have an anticipation of when, let's say, a cadence will come, when a series of chords will resolve. And we think that that's in part why music has such power, is because that mechanism allowing us to anticipate future events has been sort of capitalized upon by music to, in a sense, engage that ancient reward prediction mechanism. And even though we don't actually get a physical reward, we get a kind of intellectual reward or a cognitive reward, which in turn leads to an emotional response, and that's the chill sensation.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Take Care, a conversation on health and wellness on WRVO Public Media. I'm Lorraine Rapp.
And I'm Linda Lowen.
We're talking to Dr. Robert Zatori, who's a cognitive neuroscientist at the Montreal Neurological Institute and Hospital at McGill University. We're talking about how people can anticipate a piece of music or a pleasurable moment and their brain releases dopamine. When you're doing these studies, do the people that are participating, are they familiar with the music? Are you saying that we might anticipate a pleasurable moment of music that we aren't familiar with, that we haven't heard yet? Or is it when they know a good part of the song that they love is coming?
Right. In the case of an animal, typically you would have to train it in order for it to know what's coming up. So that would be something that is learned. In the case of music, I think there's two levels, and again, musicians have described these sorts of things as well. On the one hand, there's the level of a specific piece of music that you may know, and you may have heard it many times, and so the anticipation comes in part from your actual memory of that piece. You know that there's a favorite passage, and you can anticipate that based on your memory for that piece. But there's also a second level, which is based on your implicit knowledge of the rules of music. So in other words, as you grow up, even from quite early in infancy, you hear the music of whatever culture you're growing up in. If you're growing up in North America, you would probably hear Western music. If you grow up in India, you might hear ragas. If you grow up in Africa, you might hear a totally different system. But the point is that over time, you will hear many different types of music, all of which share some kinds of rules. And so what your brain does is it figures out the general rule system such that when you hear a completely new piece that's in that style that you're familiar with, you can still generate anticipations based upon what you have heard before, but not the specific piece. And so in our studies, we've actually done separate studies to try to look at this, and we find rather similar results. In other words, when you play music that people are highly familiar with, you will get those effects that I've described with the dopamine release. But we've also done the study with completely new music that we were sure people had never heard before, and we still saw a very similar phenomenon. So it seems like our brain is very good at making predictions, even for new events, on the basis of generalizing from a whole series of past events. In other words, your whole experience, your whole exposure to music. And that's why, you know, people who have a lot of musical training may get more out of a complex piece of music because they have more to draw on. They have more knowledge to draw upon. If you've only heard a small, you know, segment of music and not much else, then you may have more trouble.
I'm going to get personal here, Dr. Zatori, so forgive me. I have always been a word person. Lorraine's career has been deeply intertwined with music, and it's my perception that she is much more sensitive and appreciative of music than I am. Now, is there actually scientific research that backs up that people do react differently to music?
Oh, people definitely react differently to music, and I think there are several aspects of that. On the one hand, as I was saying, based upon your experience, that will determine a great deal of your musical preferences. And not only preference for genre of music, but also perhaps for a level of complexity. So within each genre, you might have, you know, very complicated music or very simple music, whether it's classical or pop or jazz or any other style you want. There will be some pieces that are really, you know, pretty straightforward and relatively easy to understand, and others that might take many, many, you know, different listenings to pick up. So I think your experience will have a great deal to do with whether you really respond to particular music or not. And then above and beyond that, we've actually done some studies looking at people who seem to have a kind of a blunted response to music without having any other problems. In other words, these are not people who are just generally depressed and suffer from what you might call anhedonia, which is a lack of pleasure or lack of ability to derive pleasure from events. These are perfectly normal people, but for whatever reason, and we're still trying to figure out why that is, they just don't get a great deal of pleasure out of music. And so there may be some, you know, different wiring in some people's brains. We're sort of working on the hypothesis that maybe in those individuals, the reward system, which is the dopaminergic system that I mentioned, may be somehow less strongly intertwined with the auditory system, which is the one that would store all that information as you perceive music throughout your lifetime.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Take Care, a conversation on health and wellness on WRVO Public Media. I'm Linda Lowen.
And I'm Lorraine Rapp.
And we are talking with Dr. Robert Satori about the neuroscience of music. He's a cognitive neuroscientist at the Montreal Neurological Institute and Hospital at McGill University. Dr. Satori, neuroscience has been using music as a window to study brain function. So what are some of the valuable things you've learned through your studies? And are these discoveries helpful in other areas of science and medicine?
Yes, I think you know, there's a lot that we've been looking at. We always think that music is, in a sense, you could think of it as the culmination of human cognitive development, and art in general, I would say, is the pinnacle of human achievement. So if we want to understand the human condition, broadly speaking, we want to understand how is it that humans produce art, and music is a particularly interesting form of art. And as neuroscientists, our job is to try to understand how the brain works. And so here we have an opportunity to look at an incredibly remarkable and complex function, which is music, that makes use of many of our most elaborated functional capacities. So everything from memory to emotion to perception to motor control, etc. We really think of it as a window onto the brain. And once you start to understand certain things about how the brain works via music, then it starts to have applications. So there is a great deal of interest in using music for various therapeutic interventions in different kinds of disorders. And music therapy has actually been around for quite a while. But I've spoken to a lot of music therapists, and they often say to me that what they are lacking is some more basic science to help them try to implement better therapies. So that's what we're trying to do, is to provide the knowledge that then they can try to put into practice. And to give you a concrete example of this, there's a great deal of interest in using music to treat movement disorders. So people who have had either a stroke or perhaps Parkinson's disease or Huntington's disease, various disorders that affect the motor system, it's been shown that under some circumstances, those people can learn to use music in order to enhance their movements, to make their movements more regular, or to help initiate movements, or to help plan their movements. And so that's an area of great study, because we can use our brain imaging technology to see what's going on in the brain when you hear music and it engages, for example, your motor system, and then try to apply that knowledge to disorders where that motor system isn't functioning quite right.
Dr. Robert Satori is the co-author of an essay that appeared in the New York Times entitled Why Music Makes Our Brain Sing. He's a professor of neuroscience at the Montreal Neurological Institute and Hospital at McGill University. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Dr. Robert Satori is a professor of neuroscience at the Montreal Neurological Institute and Hospital at McGill University. For more information on the neuroscience of music and Dr. Satori's essay, Why Music Makes Our Brain Sing, in the New York Times, visit the Take Care webpage at wrvo.org/takecare. Podcasts of our show are available on iTunes and the WRVO website.
Coming up, if you're ready to take steps to better health, a USA Today technology journalist joins us with her review of the latest wellness gadget, the fitness tracking device, your pedometer on steroids. You're listening to Take Care on WRVO Public Media.